You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Welcome to the second of Times Higher Education's books podcasts. I'm very pleased to welcome today Robert Eaglestone, Professor of Contemporary Literature and Thought at Royal Holloway, University of London. Hello, Robert.
Hi, Karen. Nice to see you.
Thank you very much for joining us. The reason I've lured you in today is to talk about our book of the week, which was written by Saul Friedlander. It is Franz Kafka, The Poet of Shame and Guilt. Now, you're a literary scholar who deals, by the nature of your research interests, with history. Saul Friedlander is an eminent Holocaust historian who has now been trading on literary scholars' patch, one might argue, with this Franz Kafka book. But before that, he made his name, I understand, through landmark studies of the Holocaust.
Yes, I think Saul Friedlander is one of the world preeminent historians of the Holocaust. And he's a really major figure. I mean, so major, in fact, there are now books on him and his history. And he has a very interesting, fascinating, in fact, life and also intellectual journey. And I think thinking about how his intellectual journey illuminates this Kafka book, and I think why it's important and interesting.
You mentioned now that, now obviously, Friedlander himself is a Holocaust survivor. His parents were killed in the Holocaust, and he himself moved from the Czech Republic, or Czechoslovakia as it then was, to France, to Israel, and now to the United States. He's a professor emeritus at UCLA. His earlier work was, I get the impression, not only important, but fairly traditional in terms of its approach.
Well, when he started, his first couple of books are very traditional, rigorous historical works. They work on the documents. One is a study of Pius XII and the Third Reich, another study of American-German relations, diplomatic relations, before 1941, and they're very sort of rigorous historical books. He then writes a book called about Kurt Gerstein, who was called the counterfeit Nazi, who was an SS officer who tried to explain what was going on during the Holocaust to outside sources, to the Swedes and so on. And that was a slightly more interesting book, trying to explore one person's life in relationship to what had been going on. But then he has a really interesting turn in the 1970s. He becomes very interested in psychoanalysis and psychoanalytic history, and he writes a really amazing memoir called When Memory Comes, which is a really astonishing book. It's a book clearly written by a historian who's interested in documents and historical facts, but also by somebody who's trying to reconstruct his life or think about how the shape of his life, and is open to thinking about dreams and reflections and all sorts of things. And it seems to mark a turn in how he thinks about perhaps himself, but that's outside one's remit, but also how he thinks about the Holocaust. And the book is terribly good and terribly moving. As I say, he's a historian. His parents escape from Prague and they go to France and they hide him in a school, and his mother, he finds the letter that his mother wrote to the headmistress. I'll read it out if that's okay. It's very...
Please.
I beg you, dear madam, to agree to look after our child and assure him your protection till the end of this terrible war. I don't know how he could best be safeguarded, but I have complete confidence in your goodness and understanding. My husband's fate and my own are now in God's hands. If he wishes us to survive, we'll see the end of this awful period. If we must disappear, we'll at least have the happiness of knowing our beloved child has been saved. The little one has plenty of clothes, underwear and shoes. There's enough money for him. I'll leave everything with you if you have the great kindness to tell me yes. We can no longer exist legally. And then Saul Friedlander writes, the letter was written on two pieces of paper of different sizes. In her hand, in places, that was not at all clear. Obviously, the handwriting was. So my mother added at the end, I beg you to excuse the appearance of this letter. My hands no longer obey me. And somehow I think that little tiny little detail about the handwriting is incredibly illuminating of a whole world. Of course, we know the story of the Holocaust in the big picture, but that little detail about the handwriting seems to sum up a whole world of suffering and pain and fear in a way which other things don't. And it's from this sort of thinking that he begins to change how he writes about the Holocaust and how he thinks about it. He wrote a very influential little book called Reflections of Nazism, an Essay on Kitchen Death. And in that book, he says very clearly that he, of course, he's dealing with historical documents and the historical record, but also with the sort of fantasies and ideas and strange, strange ideologies and dreams which shape Nazism and shape responses to it. So it's a much sort of wider sort of history.
From the title alone, that sounds as though it's veering toward cultural studies, toward literary studies, and being alert to those nuances.
That's absolutely right. And it discusses film and literature and all sorts of things. And very unusually for a historian at that time, I guess in the 80s, he's very open to the work of history that films and literature do. The way in which they can, I mean, he even says that they can illuminate things that historians can't. They can illuminate how people think about things and how people feel about things, and perhaps even give historians new ways into problems. So he's.
It's interesting that you mention that. When I corresponded with him for the author profile, he was discussing the fact that for many of his students now, and he mentioned this in an interview with Der Spiegel, for many of them, they not only know who major figures in history of Nazism and the Second World War were, they're not entirely clear who Lenin was. So that for a lot of them, their experience or their understanding of what happened in the Second World War comes from things like the miniseries Holocaust, which Friedlander said, obviously a terrible piece of kitsch, but the issue, and he said this is something he'd like to write about in future, is it better for modern society, young people, the vast majority of people, to know about the Holocaust and about the Second World War via television programs rather than not at all?
Well, I mean, that's such an interesting question, isn't it? I mean, I think the... I'm not a Holocaust historian, but I hang out with lots of Holocaust historians, and I think they're very divided on this issue. I know that some of them, some very eminent historians, think that a little bit of knowledge is better than no knowledge, and that's something you can build on. So if you have a slightly kitschy version of the Holocaust from television or from a film, then you can learn more, and that's quite a good thing. On the other hand, there are others who think that sort of misinformation about the Holocaust is not quite akin to denial, but a way of covering it up or misunderstanding it. So it's a very complicated matter, and I'd be very keen to find out what Saul Friedlander thinks about that.
Popular culture getting things wrong is inherently something that irritates academics, obviously, in the pursuit of accuracy and truth, in scare quotes or not. It's hard to be relaxed about that idea, isn't it, I would imagine, for a historian?
Well, historians get very tense about it. I suppose I have a slightly different view, I think. I think, on the one hand, I suppose I make a difference between, as it were, surface mistakes. So, for example, if you were a Holocaust historian and you watched one of the X-Men films, which has a scene set in a concentration camp, you might notice that the guards have the wrong colour uniform. And that seems to me to be completely unimportant. I mean, the wrong number of buttons on a tunic or the wrong colour uniform doesn't seem really to matter. But there seem to be more profound sorts of mistakes or wrongnesses that can really mislead or deform. I'm thinking of a very popular film and book called Boy in the Striped Pyjamas.
Yes.
Which I think is not only wrong about the details.
Wrong and dreadful work.
Wrong in sort of quite a profound way. In this book and film, two little boys, the son of the Nazi commandant of a death camp and a little Jewish boy, make
friends
through a fence. It's a terrible book. And it misses out two really important, deep historical things. One, of course, that the son of a concentration camp commander would be a little boy filled with Nazi propaganda, who would know he would understand that the Jews were evil and all these sorts of things.
And subhuman.
And he'd want to be like his daddy in the SS, and he'd want to be all these sorts of things. And similarly, another terrible lie, that little boys of 11, when they arrived at death camps, were killed straight away. They weren't allowed to survive. So that seems to be... Those are sort of deep historical errors, which seem to me to be very misleading and open to question. So I think, I suppose, you almost want to think about what sort of mistakes people make and what importance we think they are. But I mean, I also think that people do get, as exactly as you say, academics get very hung up on the colour of the uniforms, the number of buttons on the jacket, and perhaps that's a mistake. But I also think we have to be careful about mythologizing things.
Indeed. Now, getting back to Friedlander, we're discussing Saul Friedlander today with Professor Robert Eaglestone, Professor of Contemporary Literature and Thought at Royal Holloway. And we're talking about Friedlander's book, Franz Kafka, The Poet of Shame and Guilt. But to return to something you said earlier about Friedlander's work in Holocaust studies, you said that he seemed initially to be going off on a tangent, but a lot of that tangent is no longer seen in the same way.
Oh, no, I think that's absolutely right. He edited a very important book in the early 90s. Often, as publishers will tell you, collections of essays are often
not big sellers.
They're not big sellers, not highly thought of. But he edited a book called Probing the Limits of Representation, which is a book which, in a way, set the agenda for much Holocaust history and much Holocaust other academic discourse about the Holocaust. And that book, too, was about the same sense of that straightforward history in a more traditional way wasn't addressing the issues that the questions the Holocaust seemed to ask. There are problems with how historians wrote about the Holocaust, problems with how they thought about the Holocaust, and he wanted to try and ask new questions and explore new ways of doing it. And I think what's really remarkable about him is that after this book, he then produced produced an enormous, very highly respected study. It's called Nazi Germany and the Jews. It came out in two volumes, 1997 and 2007. And the second volume won the Pulitzer Prize in the States. And they are huge, what historians call synthetic history. So it comes some from the archives, but it pulls together all sorts of strands. But what's remarkable about it, apart from they're very well written, is they bring together historical documentation and historical knowledge, but also things like dreams and reflections and stories and people's fears and hopes. One of the things that Friedlander talked about a lot was the voice of the victims or the voice of the people involved, which are often glossed over by historians or not understood or taken seriously. And so these two books, while of course dealing with the historical record and the wider shapes of the events, also allow the voice of the individual to be heard, or sort of across time. So they have people's dreams and their diaries and the sense that that, you know, because history, life is lived forwards and history written or backwards, people's lives can sort of be concreted over or disappear, or it can look inevitable that in 1933 that something terrible is going to happen in the early 40s. And this book tries to, as it were, undo that. And I think it's been very well received in the public. I think it's been very well received by the historical community as well. So it's really, they set out the state of Holocaust knowledge, I think.
Were you surprised that a historian in his time of life, he was born in 1932, so he's enjoying a well-deserved retirement when a lot of people slow down, are no longer writing books, or perhaps restate what they have done during the Here Are My Greatest Hits, and as I said, this is how it was. Were you surprised that Friedlander took on a literary figure, a pre Holocaust literary figure, Franz Kafka.
I really was. I thought it was really interesting. That's one of the reasons I was keen to review it. I was keen to see what he had to say about literary texts. I was keen to see how he did it. I mean, he's as I say, literature, of course, has been part of his historical method for a long time. But to see how he's going to focus on literary figure, I thought was really interesting. And in the Kafka book, I mean, he does make some play of the fact that he and his family shared a sort of culture and milieu with Kafka, that they grew up, they were middle-class German-speaking Jews in Prague.
In Prague, that his father attended the same law school as Kafka, as you mentioned, that his uncle knew Kafka's friend and biographer, Max Brod. It seems as though there were a lot of links. Do you feel in the book he makes great play of that?
Well, oddly enough, I think he talks about that quite early in the book, and then, as it were, doesn't go much further with it. So I think he must feel some sympathy with the pre-war milieu. But I think what's really interesting is that he brings his sort of historical methodology. I hesitate slightly to call it methodology because I think he's too clever to be pinned down in a, you know, here's my system. But he brings his historical approach, perhaps, to thinking about Kafka. And remember what I was saying about letting the voice of the individual speak? I think that's one of the things he tries to do with Kafka's work. He tries to let Kafka speak as a historical individual, and also to let Kafka's sort of dreams and unconscious speak. Now, as he says himself, he feels very ill at ease, in a way, working on Franz Kafka, a figure, after all, one of the great writers of the 20th century, a figure on whom there is so much written, more written, I think, than you could read in a career, let alone, you know, in a few short
years.
Even
though his own corpus was very small.
Even his own corpus is very small. Very small, very hard, I always think.
And very distressing and very unsettling and very difficult.
No, that's absolutely right. And in fact, and I think one of the things that's interesting about, well, writers have, you know, the shares in writers go up and down, don't they? And I think one of the things about Kafka now is he's of course, a central figure in German studies and so on. But also, I think that there's a turn to Kafka in people thinking about the Holocaust.
He died in 1924.
That's right. But I think that lots of people are thinking about Kafka almost as a sort of a prophet of the Holocaust.
Yes.
I think because of his interest in shame and bodies and in Judaism and in the sort of shape of how things are in some deep way, people see him as a sort of prophet of what happened. There's a book by J. Hillis Miller, the very eminent American literary critic. It's called the Conflagration of Community, and really the almost central figure in that is Kafka as a sort of a weird telling the future
harbinger of what was to come.
Exactly. And I think that I'm a bit conflicted about this idea. I sort of think there feels to be something to it, but on the other hand, it seems almost a silly thing to say. It seems almost magical.
Sounds like writing history the wrong way around
exactly
again, as we were talking about earlier.
Exactly so. And I am. And although there may be, you know, there's certainly stuff in Kafka about bureaucracy and power.
Arbitrary detention.
Yeah, exactly. Those sorts of things and
state
shame
power.
And suffering. So clearly he's picking up on those things. But I mean, I think Friedländer doesn't go down that route. He doesn't see Kafka as a sort of prophet of something to come. But he does see him, you know, rooted in his historical time. And the book really draws on Friedländer's historical knowledge, and it tries to locate Kafka as Jewish, in his class, in his time, in the complex situation of Czechoslovakia before the war, but also in terms of, I think this is at the core of the book, Kafka's sort of sexual fantasies. And I think this is...
Sounds like there are some very dark issues discussed here. Homoerotic urges, the possibility that he may have been attracted to children. It's clear to anyone who's read the books that he's not too keen on women or heterosexual sex.
That's exactly right.
You mentioned that this is something that Friedländer looks at quite closely.
I think that's the core of the book. I think that's what Friedländer finds at the heart of Franz Kafka. He's not suggesting that Franz Kafka acted on any of these fantasies, but he's suggesting that they sort of they seep out through the work, through his letters and diaries, and they sort of spread through his writing, and they shape the sort of responses he has to things. So Friedländer is very interesting, trying to write the history of somebody's unconscious by its traces. So it's like in CERN with nuclear power labs. They obviously you can't see the fantasies. You can only see their traces, the way that they trace particles, the bubbles of particles left behind, how you trace atomic particles.
That's a very nice metaphor, Robert.
And so he's,
so is he
he's
a Freudian? Is Friedländer a Freudian?
That's a really good question. Friedländer is certainly deeply involved and interested and knows a great deal about psychoanalysis. I'm not sure anybody is a strictly Freudian today. That's a really interesting question. I suppose there's so much to jump gardens back to literary criticism. There's so much literary critical work on psychoanalysis, and there's Lacanians and Freudians and Kleinians and all sorts of different sorts. I think I would say that I would be surprised if you could pin him down to one school.
Mm-hmm.
He's certainly somebody who, in a way, like everybody, lives in a post-Freudian world where we know about the unconscious and that figures as part of how we deal with the world.
And it's hard not to draw that in when you're writing about someone who was, as he says, obsessed with shame and guilt. And
exactly so.
It does make me wonder, though, as a literary scholar, how do you feel when you read a book about a literary figure by a historian? Obviously, someone as nuanced and as interesting as Friedlander, but there's no fear that historians are sort of trading on your patch and looking at the historical background to a scholar when all good literary students know that you should be looking at the text rather than
I think there are lots and lots of ways of doing literary study, and it's literally let a thousand flowers bloom. And if historians want to write about it, that's fantastic, or psychoanalysts or what have you. I mean, literature belongs to everybody and every different discipline.
So he's not just using Kafka as a kind of, oh, and before the Holocaust, here are these.
No, not at all. Oh, I think there are historians who. Can we take two steps back on that?
Sure.
Okay, so I think that the Academy is very keen on interdisciplinary work.
We've heard.
Yeah, but very, very often that boils down to literary critics reading two history books and saying, oh, here's some history. Or historians
reading
doing
two
history,
novels.
Reading two novels and saying, oh, here's some novels. And that's, that's going the right way, but it's not doing it. But I think in the case of Friedlander, I think that he's. Particularly his way he does history, he's steeped in the culture and the ideas and the dreams and the fantasies and the unconsciouses that can be thought about in relation to literature as well as in history. So I think he's somebody who I hesitate to call him interdisciplinary because he's a historian, but he's somebody for whom those things merge together in a fantastic, productive way. So with this book about Kafka, it's not an excuse to find out about Prague before the war. It's not making a straightforward historical thesis or claim. It really is about Kafka and his world, his unconscious, and what it means. So I think it's...
Did it tell you anything about the literature? Is Friedlander a sensitive reader?
Well...
You've already said he's not sort of checking for Prague before the war details, but does he appreciate literature to the same degree you would expect of a literary scholar? Is he an alert reader?
Yeah, I really think he is. There's a fantastic chapter on Kafka's story, The Country Doctor, which offers
you mentioned that.
Yeah, it offers a really detailed...
Blunt sexual metaphors and unsettling events.
No, it's a really good reading of that story, and it's really interesting and provocative. And I can't claim to be a Kafka scholar and an expert, so I can't really judge the level of innovation that this book makes in Kafka scholarship. I mean, Friedlander draws on some leading Kafka scholars, But I think that the book is in a series called Jewish Lives. It's about thinking about eminent Jewish people in history.
However, someone who, as Walter Benjamin said, was just listening in on the Jewish tradition. He was not observant.
Yeah.
And that what reached him was merely something vague.
Gee, that was really interesting. And again, that's one of the things I felt I should go and find out more about. He's often taken as a key Jewish thinker, Kafka, and one of the things that Friedlander talks about, and drawing on Benjamin, is in fact that Kafka's Judaism is a much smaller part of his mental life than I had thought at first. And I wonder whether serious Kafka scholars may have areas to disagree with Friedlander in this. I think it's a really interesting issue.
So is it wrong to have put him in a Jewish Lives series?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, he clearly was Jewish. He talked about himself as Jewish. His family were murdered by the Nazis, and he's a writer of which various Jewish communities, feel he's one of theirs, and he clearly is. But I think, as all sorts of interesting debates have shown in the last few years, Judith Butler wrote about Kafka's papers and where they should go.
Of course, there has been that controversy about who should own them, and they are presently in Israel. They were purchased, and the question is whether they should be owned by the state.
Yeah, exactly. These are very complicated matters. And somehow you feel that those sort of complications and difficulties and questions are rather honest to Kafka's own work, aren't they? Because Kafka's work is all about questions and difficulties and things being complicated. And those questions are sort of programmed in his own literature, and they've come out now, and we're constantly debating and going over them. And I guess that's one of the mark of being a really great writer, that you somehow pose questions you don't even know you're posing that roll through time, I suppose.
Now, Friedlander, obviously, by the nature of his scholarship, deals with things that are distressing beyond measure. In the literary world, you can't get much more distressing than Kafka's work, I would say. Certainly, in terms of the great canon of 20th century literature, there's not much comfort to be had in any of these books. I think a lot of people might prefer that they didn't have images of the Metamorphosis or the Trial in their mind.
No, that's true. Or I remember when I was much younger, I read the one with the torturing machine in the penal colony. Stayed with me for a long time. I'm a slightly funny person to ask about that. I suppose in my mind, I mean, I read lots of Holocaust testimony and Holocaust history, and I sort of think that it is terrible being turned into a beetle. But
that's also pretty small potatoes.
It's also funny in a way,
right.
And compared to some of the things that people have written about in their testimonies, I sort of think, well, it's awful, but terrible things happen. But also in my mind is Toni Morrison's wonderful novel *Beloved*, and that also is quite terrible. So perhaps I'm a bad person to ask about that, because I spend my time reading lots of terrible things.
We're speaking to Robert Eaglestone, professor of contemporary literature and thought at Royal Holloway. Now, Robert, you were made a professor at the impudently young age of 36. Given to understand, which is unusual in this day and age. How did you end up in the fields that you ended up in? What drew you toward your study of Holocaust literature?
Oh, that's a really good question. I started off, I did my first degree in Manchester, and I found myself very interested in literature, of course, but I found myself very interested in philosophical questions or literary theory, and I found myself interested in issues of ethics. And I felt the question of literature and ethics was something that wasn't being addressed either by literary theory or by more traditional literary criticism. And so that became my interest. And I became very interested in deconstruction and Derrida. And I discovered that Derrida had been extremely influenced by a Lithuanian-French Jewish philosopher called Emmanuel Levinas. And so I, for my doctoral research, I worked on Levinas, who was a Holocaust survivor. He'd been in the French army and was put in a terrible camp for French military prisoners of war. The Nazis didn't murder Jewish prisoners of war because they were frightened that the Allies would notice and murder their own prisoners. But all Levinas's family in Lithuania were murdered. Maurice Blanchot, the strange French writer, saved his wife and daughter, and later they were hidden by nuns in the south of France. And so Levinas's work is saturated with the Holocaust. And having written about Levinas and literature and ethics, I found myself drawn to thinking about the Holocaust in philosophy and in literature and in history. And I was very fortunate that at Royal Holloway, a very eminent German Holocaust historian, Peter Longerich, had just begun a Holocaust Research Centre, which I became very involved.
You're presently deputy director, and were previously director.
Well, I was director for an interim year. David Tesserani is the director now, but we have a number of really world-class Holocaust historians and film experts and so on, and it was a great privilege for me to work with them. I am, like lots of literary theory people, I was slightly snobby about history and historians, and I thought, well, they're just writing blah, blah, blah. But by hanging out with really world-class historians, Dan Stone, David Cesarani, Peter Longerich, Zoe Waxman, I sort of come to appreciate, my view has completely changed. I think history is an extraordinarily hard discipline. I think it asks really demanding questions. It can be quite conservative, intellectually conservative, but that might not be a bad thing. And I think that it's really an astonishing discipline. And I say this sometimes, that I'm not a historian, but when you know the sorts of questions historians ask and how they ask them and how they plan to answer them, then you have a sense of how historians work, and I sometimes pass as a Holocaust historian from time to time, although I'm really not. I bluff.
So literary scholars can learn more from historians than just thinking about the role of the Industrial Revolution as replicated in certain 18th century novels.
I think that's absolutely right. I think the we talked about interdisciplinary earlier on. The question is, what questions do historians ask? What questions do literary studies ask? What questions do philosophers ask? And when you know the questions and the sort of way they're asking them, and that's often with historians very historically specific, because obviously Holocaust historians ask different questions from historians of the English Civil War. And when you know the sort of questions and what they're reading, then you have a sense of how it is they're working. And I think that illuminates one's own work very interestingly.
And how do historians feel about literary scholars? You've already given them props. Do they give you props?
Well, I think that's a very interesting issue. As I say, history is a very can be a very intellectually conservative discipline. I think Saul Friedlander is an exception in that, actually. I think Saul Friedlander has really made all sorts of intellectual running in history. Historians are very suspicious of sort of fads and isms and so on. And obviously, in history studies...
They don't go pack it on Judith Butler.
No, absolutely not. Whereas in history studies, we love isms and fads and trends. And I think that's part of a good difference in letting a thousand flowers bloom.
An intellectual snapshot of literary scholars would be flares, loon pants, really embarrassing trends. The historians would always be
in tweed,
well turned out.
In tweed, yeah, exactly so. But I think the very best historians, for example, I don't keep boasting about my lovely colleagues in Royal Holloway, but the Holocaust Research Centre, they're very open to different sorts of things. I know that Dan Stone, for example, is extraordinarily well-read in European fiction, has always read interesting novels before I have, and they form part of his work and how he thinks about things. David Cesarani, of course, often reviews novels and things and puts them in their historical context. I mean, I think there's interesting work to be done there, but I also think that they are literary studies and history are separate disciplines with different ways of seeing the world.
And you're happy for them to remain that way rather than some great convergence where all disciplines will end up in a big pot.
Oh, I think that would be, I think that would, well, one, be impossible, and two, I'm not sure what it would really tell you about things if they all end up in one sort of pot. I mean, I really genuinely believe that, as the Friedlander shows, that the deep understanding of disciplines can really illuminate things, but it's quite hard to achieve a deep understanding of disciplines. You have to hang out with historians for a long time and read quite a lot of history.
You have to put the hours in, Robert.
You have to put the hours in before you know what they're talking about and why it's important. And it's true to do with historians. To explain why certain things are important or why this poet or that poet is successful or not successful is a very complicated matter. But I think that's really one of the joys of intellectual life is, as it were, being at the edges of your disciplines and seeing how they relate to other disciplines.
Now, Saul Friedlander will be 81 this year. I asked him, and he said he wasn't sure how it would happen, how Holocaust scholarship will change when there are no longer scholars for whom the Holocaust is a living memory, or indeed readers or other people. What do you think?
Well, that's a really powerful question. I don't know the answer to that. I'm writing a book in which that's one of the questions at the moment. I suppose I have a number of worries about it. One is, of course, that it's very easy for the Holocaust to be turned into a myth, and that can be done by
a great metaphor.
A great metaphor. It can be done for good reasons to say, you know, this is the most important thing that happened in the 20th century, and. Or it can be done for bad reasons by people who've got hidden agendas.
The David Irvings.
Yeah. Or even perhaps not even so explicit as that. But I think that's, and one of the things about survivors is that they consistently puncture that myth making process, because you sit next to Kitty Hart Moxon, who's a survivor from Auschwitz. She's a fellow at Royal Holloway. And you sit next to her and you think, this is, as a little girl, she was in the Polish swimming team, she lived in the ghetto, she survived Auschwitz, she did all these amazing things. And there she's sitting next to you, and it somehow punctures the myth-making and the kitschy TV series in a really powerful way. So when those people aren't there anymore, that form of puncturing will be broken. But I think we have to find other ways of stopping mythologization. Partially that's the job of historians we talked about films and so on, to constantly say, no, it wasn't like that or it was like this. Partially it's the job of writers to try and find ways of, Kafka talks about how literature, the point of literature is it acts to break the frozen sea within us. So writers have a job of breaking that frozen sea and saying, look, it's not a myth, we have to see it in its complicated kinds of ways. So I think that part of the answer is to try and keep that sense of puncturing the Holocaust myth, and I say the myth can be created for good and bad reasons, with scholarship or with literature, and I think that's quite an important way of trying to approach that problem.
There are plenty of reasons why what scholars have to say about events or indeed conditions on Earth are not necessarily what people who have survived them would say. I mean, Matthew Rice, one of my colleagues, his father, Carol Rice, famous film director, Matthew wrote a piece for us a while ago in which he looked at what some scholars had to say about his father's work. And Matthew thinks that, you know, perhaps his father would have been quite astonished to see what the scholars had made of that work. As a Holocaust scholar, whether you're a historian or a literary scholar, the fact that you may be sitting near someone or addressing people who have lived through it must give you pause for thought about flights of fancy or talking rubbish.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And I think also in this field, actually, you don't, in a sense, you don't have to think about addressing just survivors. But I mean, their children and their grandchildren. But you know, it's in Holocaust studies or any of the areas that study terrible atrocities. These are very serious matters, and they're not places for exactly, say, flights of fancy. And I think that I think all scholars who work in this field do take that quite seriously. And that sounds rather pious, doesn't it? You think, well, I take it very serious, it's a serious matter. But it
doesn't sound
of,
pious. It sounds quite well advised.
Yeah,
actually,
it really is a serious thing that you shouldn't mess about with.
Are they the ultimate check?
Well, that's a really difficult matter. I mean, I think that very eminent Holocaust historians talk privately about talking with survivors and how survivors say, well, it wasn't like that, or can be quite angry sometimes.
And yet we know that through various memoirs, things have been remembered and contradicted by other people.
Yeah.
And that there have been many memoirs that have, not the ones that were fraudulent memoirs, but memoirs of people who did experience it but remembered things inaccurately.
Well, exactly. Well, there's two matters, aren't there? One is, as it were, historical inaccuracies. There's a very famous account of a survivor who claimed that during the uprising in Auschwitz, all four gas chambers were blown up. And we know from the historical record that one was blown up, one was set on fire. And so that her testimony, yes, well, the detail of the fact was wrong. But so that's that surface anachronism we were talking about before,
yes,
in a way. But there's clearly something in testimonies, when you read lots of testimonies, there's something going on that, as it were, no account of historical documents or records can get at, which is something like, obviously you can't experience, you can't feel what it's like to be at Auschwitz, but you can almost feel your inability to feel it. You have some odd connection to it. That's part of the thing that I've been writing about quite a lot. So there's this sort of deep thing that goes on that history finds it hard to get to, I think.
So you're always on the outside looking in for a very obvious
reason.
Yeah,
but I think one of the answers to your question is that you know, disciplines have very history more than literature perhaps, but have rules about how they work. I mean, in history there are rules of argument about using sources, about sort of deduction and so on. And when Holocaust deniers make stuff up and fake documents and make translation mistakes and so on, historians quite rightly say, look, this is a mistake, this isn't history, this is just propaganda. So there are rules of how things work. And it's true that the rules often don't take into account, for example, survivors' accounts or survivors' feelings. But there comes a point when a historian, I guess, has to say, look, I've come to this conclusion about what happened in Minsk or whatever. through the sort of the rules of argument of my discipline, okay? And I see that's different from your experience, but this is how a historian sort of understands it, and that makes that's the shape of an argument, if you see what I mean. So when people might say, "Oh no, it's not like that," then historians could respond by saying, "Well, this is how." You'll have to adjust my argument to what you say or think about it, but this is what the record shows. And I think there's a certain scholarly humility which involves saying, well, this is what, speaking as a historian, this is what I've found out as a historian. And that's different from somebody who's experienced something. But I think there's an analogy in literary studies, which is that, which happens to me all the time, you know, at expensive cocktail parties, you talk
expensive
to somebody.
Expensive cocktail parties, Robert. Where does this happen?
I wish I went to expensive cocktail parties. But when you talk to somebody who's read the same novel as you and they discover you're a professor, they're suddenly a bit frightened. But obviously, if you read a novel and you've had interesting thoughts about it, that doesn't matter whether you're a professor or an accountant or a banker or a journalist. You know, you've got interesting things to say about it. And just because the professor can say, oh, it relates to this, and it's like this, and doesn't make the professor's reading any different from the bankers or accountants or journalists or teachers' reading.
Not all equally valid, but all equally interesting?
There's something like that. I think this is again, a very complicated matter, but I think that's absolutely right. And I think one of the things about literature is it gives people things, interesting things to talk about and interesting ways to think about themselves and the world. And I think that if once you start saying only so-and-so can talk about it like that, you've lost something. So there is something quite important about a sort of scholarly humility, which obviously is very irritating for scholars because they spend hours and days and years studying things and they're very keen to say, no, it's like that.
But you mean to tell me you're not humble, Robert? You're blushing now. I'm speaking to Robert Eaglestone, Professor of Contemporary Literature and Thought at Royal Holloway. We're discussing Saul Friedlander's book, Franz Kafka, The Poet of Shame and Guilt. Now, what about your forthcoming work, Robert? You've made allusions to things you are working on. You have no shortage of books and works to your credit. What's next from you?
I'm very flattered. I suppose I've got three things I'm really interested in. I've got a short book coming out on contemporary fiction, which I really enjoyed writing, a very short introduction to contemporary fiction. That's coming out later on this summer. I've got two collections of essays coming out. But I'm working really on three things. One is I'm nearly at the end of another book about the Holocaust, which is about many of the issues we've discussed. It's about literature and history, about how we understand the Holocaust, about how literature can help us think about and understand and make it and come to terms with the Holocaust in different sorts of ways. And that's been very influenced by Saul Friedlander. That's one of the reasons I was very keen to review the book and by his sorts of ideas. So that's near completion.
You've made a face there.
I've made a face there. Yeah, it's near completion.
If your publisher is listening, it's practically done.
It is practically done. It needs a bit more going over, but it's near done. I'm also very keen to write a book. I teach a course on philosophy and literature, and one of the interesting things I had about that is teaching Plato and Aristotle to students and trying to explain why these ideas, which seem so weird, Plato's Platonic forms, are actually really, I'm not sure they're right answers. They're
fun,
really interesting answers to complicated things. So I'm trying to write a book about classical literary criticism to try and show how lots of those sorts of debates in Aristotle and debates in Plato, are still really, really alive. So to use contemporary literature and contemporary film and maybe video games to talk about what Plato and Aristotle talk about and show how these debates, which are 2,500 years old, are still completely contemporary.
I've been joined in the studio today by Robert Eaglestone from Royal Holloway. We've been speaking about Saul Friedlander's book, Franz Kafka, The Poet of Shame and Guilt. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Karen.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.